Hi, this is Ruth Elizabeth Hancock, host of Work Your Energy podcast. Welcome this week again to Stephen Hawley Martin, round two, where we're going to be talking about consciousness shift, the consciousness shift in the planet at the moment. He is the author of more than 36 books and the founder of Oakley Press, a publishing house. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Elizabeth. I'm excited about chatting with you again today.
Me too. So I think we both feel, don't we, that the shift in consciousness is such an important conversation and topic right now that we felt it was worth doing another podcast about it. And I'm really excited. I've just read your other book around this with all the science listed. I mean, just so many references. You know, it's just unbelievable how you can do so much research. But it really is. We've moved on so much, haven't we, since Max Planck, the early 1900s, who really did say that there is no such thing as matter. And we now are, more than 100 years later, understanding that this still rings true. And there really isn't anything, nothing is physical. It's all underpinned by consciousness. Consciousness is creating everything. And so if we think about where we are now in our current state of the world, you know, with all the wars and things going on, how is this conscious shift, the consciousness shift, going to affect and help us at this point in humanity?
Well, I think Elizabeth said that it'd be a tremendous help when more and more people realize and come to, and sh their consciousness does shift, so that they understand that really consciousness underlies everything. There's really only one consciousness, one mind, of which we are all part, and that we are sort of, I think of ourselves as sort of like probes that are sent forth, but we're not only who we think we are based on our egos and our upbringing and the culture we're born into and so on, our parents and so forth, but we're also this one mind. I had a, I don't know if we talked about it last time, a mystical experience when I was about 35 years old, where I actually became that one mind, although I still had my own perception. I was meditating out in my backyard. It was a beautiful day, about 75 degrees, probably sunny, blue sky, white puffy clouds, and I was meditating, and I just suddenly saw auras around the trees, auras around the flowers, and I went into this state where whatever I thought about, I knew about. I knew all the answers. I somehow connected with what people call the Akashic Records, I guess. And it was just a feeling of love and amazing thing. Well, that's who we really are, each and every one of us at the core. And once we realize that, we look at the world differently. It's really the world that we have made, we and the one mind of which we're all part. So, when you know that and you realize that your brothers and sisters and even your enemies are all part of you and part of that oneness, it's hard to get out there and have wars, I think, and kill each other. So what do you think about it?
Well, do you feel that the people around us are different aspects of us? Because everything is a frequency, everything is resonance. So we are obviously attracting the same resonance, you know, same frequencies of people around us. So are the people around us in our life, are they different aspects of us? Or are they lessons, things that we need to learn? So we learn about ourselves through them, things like this. I understand that it's all one mind, but I also understand this is really hard for people to get their head around to understand, you know, like, how can I be here and you know, my husband is there? How can we be the same person, the same mind?
Well, it is hard to understand or get your mind around, as you say. But think of yourself really, you're not, Your body is not you. Your body is your vehicle for coming into this reality. And you perceive things through your five senses, through your eyes, your ears, your taste, your touch. And so it seems like your consciousness is located in your head because your brain is the receiver of consciousness. You actually are non-physical and non-local. You're part of this field that we're all living, coming from, I guess. And so I think the Hindus call it Maya, which is the illusion of the physical world, that it's really not there in the way that we perceive it through our senses. Think of this: the only way we perceive anything in when we're in this reality, unless we're psychic, unless we are one of the few people who see ghosts and things like that, the only thing we see is what comes in through those senses. And it's our brain has been conditioned over evolution, over the millennia, the times that we've been incarnating, to direct our attention to those things that are important to us. And there are things, I heard a story once about the when the Spanish came to Mexico in the met the Mayans. The Mayans, the native people there, could not see the ships that the Spanish came in because they didn't have any reference, any context. They'd never seen boats that large, and so they actually couldn't see them. It's because our brain has been conditioned to see what is important to our survival, just as our ego evolved because of the need to survive, to worry about, whether there's a lion behind that bush, or where am I going to get my food tomorrow? So it's Maya, it's an illusion. There is no place where one vibration stops and another starts, and it's all vibration. We are living in a world of vibrations. Absolutely true what you said, that we attract to us what's vibrating at the same frequency. That's how people come into our lives, and they come in because we attract them. And I think it's also true that we learn from them. We're here to experience, learn, and evolve. And what comes to us is what we need to be confronted with in order to evolve. And we have problems. Life is difficult. There's no question about that. But if we face those difficulties as learning opportunities to learn, then we're going to have a much better, pleasant, more pleasant life, because we realize that's what it's really all about. And if you're someone who keeps attracting the same kind of problems to you, what you need to do is wake up and say, now, what is it in me that's causing that kind of problem to come to me? And what do I need to change about myself so that it'll stop happening? What do you think about all?
Yeah, changing your frequency or changing your energy, as Joe Dispenza says, changes your life. Absolutely. I work with people on, busting their limiting beliefs so that they can start to see reality in a different way. And it really does work. Their reality shifts, not them that shifts, it's the reality shifts. And it's very hard for people to understand, how can my reality shift when I'm just sitting in my house? But it can, So again, these are things that people really don't understand. And even scientists are still grappling with this whole concept of everything being consciousness, everything being the one mind, everything being created by a creator energy that we call consciousness. And, and where we fit into that. I mean, I think one of the questions I'm always being asked is, do we come here for a reason? I know everyone says we chose to come here. Have we come here for a reason? What is that reason? What is it that we chose to come here to do?
Well, I think we did come here for a reason. It could be just to experience this reality, but I think it's probably more likely that each one of us has some particular thing, in addition to just experiencing this reality, that we came here either to do or to learn. It could be that we came here to overcome karma. Some karma would be attracting that same situation over and over again. Maybe we came here to overcome whatever it is It's causing that. You know, one of the, I'm a Rosicrucian adept. I've studied metaphysics through all of their courses. And the basic law of metaphysics is like attracts like. Now, that's come out in different ways in modern times, you know, the law of attraction. We attract, well, it's true. We attract to us what we are and what we resonate. And so if you're not attracting the life that you want, you need to get in touch with Elizabeth here, who can help you raise your frequency so you'll start attracting what you do want. It's really, and as far as the scientists are concerned, you know, there still are those who are hanging on to this idea that only matter exists. It's an 18th, 19th century idea. And I think it was Carl Jung who said, we make progress one funeral at a time. So those people are dying off. And now this shift is occurring. And it's really coming on very rapidly. I can feel it. I can see it in the videos and the podcasts and in the even to a certain extent in the media, that things are changing, and there are legitimate, you know, serious scientists who are studying it. Idealism, it's called, where you everything is one mind, and we're different aspects of it. We are each the one mind. There you go.
Okay. So what is your take on this story? You write it in your book about Katie, the domestic help, and she turned her skin to gold. It's amazing. And I really think that the listeners will love this story. So do you want to just sort of tell us what that is while I try and remember what I was thinking about?
Yeah. Katie, the gold leaf lady. I heard this story from a man, professor, tenured professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland. I interviewed him a couple of times, and he has some fascinating stories. And he has written a whole book about Katie, the gold leaf lady, and other parapsychological phenomena. And basically, Katie was a literate woman who was a domestic, a maid, and she was one of 12 children. But she had a very, or has, I assume she's still alive. This story probably took place about 20 years ago. She was able to, she was psychic. She would help the police solve murders or robberies or whatever. She was, sometimes she knew so much, she was able to see so much about a particular crime that for, in some cases, they thought maybe she did it. But then they would catch the true perpetrator. But she was able to apport objects. She could take them from one place with her mind and they would arrive somewhere else. And apparently she apported a carving set that's just appeared. And her husband said, oh, well, it's not really worth anything. And after that, gold, what looked like gold leaf appeared on her skin. And there's actually a video on YouTube that if your listeners and viewers want to look it up, it's a gold leaf lady. And you could, he's videoed her with the foil, looks like foil on her skin, coming out of her skin and on her back and on her arms. And Dr. Browdy is the man's name who wrote about this. He actually took some of that and had it analyzed. And it was 20% zinc and 80% copper, brass. It wasn't gold. And his theory is that she started producing this gold leaf that looked like gold, false gold on her skin, to get back at her husband who had, you know, said something she didn't like about it. It's not worth anything. So, but it shows and demonstrates that the mind can create matter. It's amazing. I mean, it appeared on her skin. And as I said, he's got the videos to prove it. So there you go.
It's interesting that it happens unconsciously without her actively directing the energy. And it would, you know, it would make me sort of ask the question, why is that? And is something else directing the energy? Because the energy needs to be directed by the mind, the one mind. So what's directing it unconsciously through her subconscious?
Well, I think that is, it is her subconscious. We produce all kinds of things for ourselves, circumstances and maybe not matter, but conditions subconsciously. We bring that upon ourselves. We're thinking into this one mind, and it's coming, what we're maybe subconsciously thinking into it is coming back to us in the form of our reality, that our circumstances that are surrounding us, that we're in. So the fact that it is the is material substance is what's amazing. Not so much to me that her subconscious mind is producing it, because that's what the subconscious mind does. It produces our circumstances.
I find it interesting that she is not an intellectual. And I think that we have intellectualized ourselves so much that we have lost most of our abilities. You know, the ego dominates. Everything has to be, you know, like we're so academic and, you know, there has to be a rational, logical explanation for everything. I think we've overdone it. We've done it to such an extent that we're actually, we've now lost the magic of the subconscious mind, and the conscious mind and the ego is just ruling everything and creating a very boring existence, I hasten to add.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right in the fact that she is an illiterate, that she doesn't, she's not a learned person. She doesn't know that she can't do these things that she does, and so she does them. And I think it's true that probably when we humans were in a more primitive state, and we had the shaman was one of the leaders of the tribe, we all probably had some of these abilities that we've lost because we're, you know, we've become come to think that we can't, because science told us for the last couple of hundred years that we can't, and so we believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually now started teaching intuitive development to people so that they can claim back some of these lost abilities, because I can feel, because with this shift in consciousness, you can really feel the energy waves changing. And I think this is making more people wake up, you know, whatever that means. And more people are starting to, I think, understand that they're capable of more, but they don't actually quite know what that is. And I think, again, this is the shift in consciousness. Things are really, really changing. And I know, you know, you talk about this in your book. What sort of examples do you have to evidence this shift in consciousness that you yourself feel is happening in the world right now?
Well, the first book that I wrote about all this and used quantum mechanics as the quantum double slit experiment as an example of mind making matter and causing the experiment to change, the outcome of the experiment to change based on what the researcher knew, what he was conscious of. I wrote that book and published it in 1995. And I can tell you that I got all kinds of flack from people who just thought it was a bunch of BS. And the last most recent book I wrote with that kind of information in it just came out in July, and it's got 4.5 star rating on Amazon because it's gotten so many positive reviews. So just the idea that people who read the book and reviewed it almost 30 years ago were like, that's a bunch of BS. And now they're saying, hey, yeah, that's really good stuff. I like, you know, I'm going to read this book a second time. That's what's changed for me personally because of this shit. Let me say one thing about, you reminded me of a guy I interviewed. His name is Skip Atwater. Skip is a nickname, but can't think of his real first name. But he set up the Stargate unit of the U.S. Army that was an intelligence unit to spy on the Soviet Union and the East Bloc countries back in the 70s and 80s. And they spied on them with psychics. These people were not psychics when they recruited them. What they did is they gave the soldiers a questionnaire, and there were certain answers that were given that made them realize these people are candidates for this job because they can easily be trained to be remote viewers. Well, Skip, I'll tell you a story about him that he told me. When he was a child, he would at night leave his body and go roaming around, you know, like, and of course, most parents would say, you're just dreaming. But he really did. And one of the problems with that is he would leave his body and go to the bathroom, but his body was still back in the bed. And so he would wet the bed. Well, his mother was into all this stuff, you know, 50 years ago, whatever that was, and said, you know, Skip, when you go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you got to take your body with you. And that way he stopped wetting the bed. But he was the guy who set up this Stargate unit of the US Army and successfully spied on our enemies for, I don't know, I think it was he's over 10 years. He was ahead of it.
Is that using an actual Stargate or like remote viewing? Was he part of the remote viewing team of the, I think it's the, is it the Blue Project, Blue Beam Project or something?
Yeah, his was called Stargate. There, Ingo Swann
Yeah.
was another one doing that on more on a freelance basis, I guess. But another person I've talked, maybe you'll ha want to have him on your podcast, is not only Skip Atwater. I'll send you his full name after I've been able to look it up. But another one is Stefan Schwartz, and he does remote viewing for, more for archaeological kind of thing, digs and things like that. And he's an accomplished remote viewer. His story that's amazing in 2003, I believe it was before, during the Iraq War, he taught a class at Atlantic University in Virginia Beach on remote viewing, teaching people how to remote view. And he had 47, I think, pupils in that class. And at the end, he asked them all to remote view the capture of Saddam Hussein, who had not yet been captured, even though the war was going on. And he got the 47 remote viewers' information and matched up what, jived between them. And there were something like a dozen different things that, and he had that locked into, he had it notarized, locked in a safe. And when Saddam Hussein was captured 6 weeks later, pulled that out, and every one of them matched. The town that he was captured, that he had a lot of money on him, $750,000, that he was defiant, that he had a that he was armed, he had a pistol with him, I don't know, something like a dozen different things, all every one of them correct. So that's a case of remote viewing the future, the problem. And so it, that tells us that really there is no time as we perceive it. We perceive it here as a dimension, but there's only the present. And when you're remote viewing, you could. There are cases where people remote view and they don't realize they're seeing something that was in the past. There's another example where there was a tower, a water tower or something, and when the picture was drawn of this area, they realized that that water tower had been torn down about 30 years prior, but it had been there just like that. So it's fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah, it's taken me a long time to get my head around this whole concept of past, present, future is all happening at the same time. But I am beginning to understand this now. And actually, it's quite liberating because it really helps me to understand we're able to live longer than we believe. And science is really pointing us in this direction now. And, I think we are going to live longer as a species that, everything has just been, we've just been so limited for such a long time. And I suspect that this is possibly that people in our world, I think they know about consciousness and they know the true reality of nature. And I think they've kept it to themselves. But I think that this is just really coming out now and nothing can stop it coming out. It is shifting. Everything is shifting.
Absolutely is. It absolutely. What you just said reminded me of another interview I had with. Are you and your listeners familiar with Edgar Cayce?
Oh yes, we talked about him last time. Yes, and I know you are a fountain of knowledge about Edgar Cayce, which is great because I have not read his books, so.
Yeah, Edgar Cayce. For those who didn't see the last interview, lived between eight born in 1877 and died in 1945. And during his lifetime, he was known as the sleeping prophet because he would put himself into a self-induced trance twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, and would answer questions that people had. And most of these questions had to do with health issues where the person had a problem that the doctors didn't seem to be able to solve. And so he was he's also known as the sort of the founder of holistic medicine. But I interviewed his son. I've interviewed several people who are experts on the psychic readings of Edgar Cayce. There are 14,000 of them. All of them were taken down by a stenographer. I think you could even buy a disc or something like that now. But I interviewed his son, who, when he was still alive, he was 95 years old, and he talked about how his father was able to do that. And as far as he often predicted the future, Edgar Casey did. His son said it was like his father could see the future kind of in a two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional plane, and that it was like if a bug is going across the room, that if it keeps going where it's going, it's going to get to a certain place. And that was how he saw the future. If things keep going the way they're going, then this is going to happen. And so I just thought I'd throw that out for what it's worth. He could see that. We do have free will, and we can change the future.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I always say this to everyone, you know, that what we're seeing around us are future potentials, and you can choose to grab any of them, or you can, you know, you can not. It's entirely up to you. It's all free will.
Conscious mind may block you from choosing a good future because of your beliefs.
Yeah, self-sabotaging. Yes, exactly. And I've noticed that more and more people are waking up to this concept of self-sabotaging now, because, you know, when you look back at your life and you can see patterns that just keep repeating themselves again and again, I'm really, really pleased to see that more people are waking up to that. I really am. One of the things I was going to say was that I wondered if maybe Edgar Casey was channeling a certain entity or spirit who is channeling this information through him, rather than Casey having the information himself from his own mind.
Yeah, that's a good question. And there was a channel that was being, someone who was being, an entity that was being channeled. I believe it was in England, and I don't remember the details. Channel said that he would like to come through Edgar Casey. Apparently, there were a few times when he channeled somebody, but for the most part, he himself would go to the Akashic Records. And he said that it was like going into a library and, you know, asking for certain information, and it would come to him. So his channels, his psychic readings did not come through another entity. They came directly from the infinite mind, from the Akashic Records. So that's why they were probably more pure, more accurate. They weren't slanted or tilted. They were just the raw information coming through him. And his son said that there were a few times when other entities came through, but it was very rare.
I always wondered because he gave such incredible medical advice. And yeah. I always wondered, you know, maybe he was even connecting with a past life where he was a doctor or something like this, you know, accessing, because he just seemed to have so much knowledge. And I understand that he could get this knowledge from the Akashic Records, but to do it 14,000 times, you know, I mean, this may be why he didn't live quite so long as he should have done, I think.
Yeah, I think he got a little discouraged toward the end and decided it was time to check out. But interesting, reminded me of another story about Edgar Casey, where there was someone who sat in. I don't know whether it was his son that I talked to or who it was, but people were coming to him who had malaria. And he noticed that for several times in a row, Edgar Casey recommended quinine, and in other cases, he didn't. And so later on, the person asked Edgar Casey, well, why do you sometimes recommend quinine and sometimes you recommend this other therapy? And he said, well, for a quinine mind, you need to recommend quinine. So it was the individual who would accept quinine as a cure, whereas someone else would benefit from a different kind of therapy. So yeah, he not only recommended cures, but they were tailored to the mind of the individual who was going to be using them, if you see what I mean.
Okay, so tailored to their beliefs, their belief structures, rather than tailored to their body and their functional needs.
And probably either one of them would have worked if the person believed that they would work. Because really that's what it all boils down to, is what you believe. I mean, you can cure yourself with your beliefs.
Yeah.
That's what the placebo effect is all through medicine. That's why they do double blind trials of different medicines, because often the placebo will outperform the real stuff.
And yeah, I mean, it is all about beliefs, isn't it? Which is just mind-blowing in itself, really. But I find that a lot of people, because we talk about beliefs, a lot of people think it's all mind. And what I've really discovered in my research is it's not. It's mind, heart. And you know, if you like, we could even say that the heart is the connection to, you know, the energy field, the divine quantum realm, whatever it is. I think we connect through the heart because we connect through our vibration, which is emotions, feelings. But there are the thoughts, the words, and the thoughts as well, which is the mind. So I think it's really important to remember that the heart mind connection.
Yes, well, it's true. I agree with you. I agree with you 100% that feelings, which is the heart, are really very powerful. I mean, you can believe something intellectually, but if you don't believe it with your feelings, with your heart, it's not going to work to attract what it is you want. I don't know if I'm saying that well.
Yeah, and it's probably not true. So I always say to people, you need to think with your heart, you know, you because our body, our heart, if you like, knows truth. It recognizes the frequency of truth, whereas the mind, you know, it's all logic and rational thinking and analytical thinking, which I think can trip us up when we're not aware of that. But I feel when we connect to the heart, it's not so easy to be tripped up. This is the challenge for us now, and something that we talked about as well in the last podcast, moving from the third to the fourth density, from a lower density to a higher density, and fourth density is the heart. The fourth chakra is the heart. So we're moving more into a heart-led species. And again, I think again, this is something that people really don't understand. What's your take on this, moving into this
Yeah.
fourth density?
Well, I think we are definitely moving into it. It's realizing what we're talking about today, that all is one, that we're all part of this one life, and that, what we do to others, we do to ourselves. And it's all of that. And what it makes me think of, I can't think of the guy's name, but he developed a muscle technique where he could tell the
Oh,
truth.
David Hawkins, Dr. David Hawkins.
Hawkins, yes.
Yeah, his
What's the name of his
emotional
book? Power,
versus force.
yeah, Power versus Force. And he was apparently able to tell whether or not something was true, like yes or no questions, based on whether your muscle remained your, I think he used the arm, but some people use their fingers, like that.
Yeah, the kinesiology. Yeah, I use that. I do use that with people. And it's because it's connected to the subconscious mind. So again, the subconscious knows when something is true or not true. So as long as you're connecting to the subconscious mind, which you can do, I think, you know, through the muscle thing and through this. And I actually use the sway test. I actually have found that is the easiest way for people to do it. That really does link to the subconscious mind. But I know Dr. David Hawkins, he created this emotional chart, the Hertz emotion chart, which of course you can see all over, you know, the internet these days. And it's very useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I published a book about that by a lady who was a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she used the finger to tell, and she could take your hand and ask questions, and she'd know, what was going on in your subconscious. And by the way, Edgar Cayce was that was one of the things I didn't say that his son said that he could see, he could read the person's subconscious mind. And he found that many times it was a past life that was causing their problems. And that's how all this sort of stuff came out. If somebody was afraid of water, it was because they drowned in a previous life, or those kinds of things. So yeah.
Yeah, I found the same thing actually, which brings us on to another story in your book, which is the story of James, the fighter pilot who came
Oh.
back, the 2-year-old. And it's not, I don't think this story is that old, is it? I think what, 10 or 20 years old.
Yeah, he was born in James was born in 1998, I believe. So yeah, 20 years ago. And when he was about 2 years old, he started having these dreams where he would scream out in the middle of the night, "Airplane on fire, little man can't get out. Airplane on fire, little man can't get out." And mother and father would rush into the room, and the child was really going berserk there in the crib. And basically, long story short, is that James remembered being a fighter pilot in World War II. His mother took him to a Air and Space Museum, not because he was claiming to be having been a pilot, but this is how she kind of got onto this, was that he saw a Corsair, which is a airplane, American airplane that flew off aircraft carriers in World War II, said, "Mommy, that's I flew that kind of plane in my previous, I don't know if he said previous life, but and he started talking about it, and it had a tank under the wing, and she said, "Well, look, it's got a bomb." She said, "Oh no, Mom, that's not a bomb. That's a drop tank." And she said, "Well, what's a drop tank?" "A drop tank takes more gasoline so the plane can go farther. And they, when it's empty, they just drop it from the wings." And so how he knew all this stuff, his father was very skeptical. These folks lived in Louisiana. They were Southern Baptists who, of course, don't believe in reincarnation. It's not part of their doctrine. So they didn't think it was possible. But after a while, they just, he was coming up with so many things. He knew people's names. His father asked him what the name of the ship was that he was on, that he flew from. And he said it's the Natoma, the Natoma. His father looked up Natoma, and yes, there was a Natoma Bay at the Battle of Iwo Jima in April of 1945. Little James knew all these things. They even knew the names of some of the men that he flew with. And when there was a reunion of the Natoma Bay people who were on the Natoma Bay during that battle, when I believe James was 6 years old, and his father took him to that reunion, and he recognized these people, and he said, "They're so old." Of course, it was, what, 2006, and the battle had taken place, however many, 60 years before. So, just an amazing story, and all kinds of things that connected. In fact, it was reported on, and one of the few things like this reported on in the mainstream media. It was on one of the networks. There was a little story about it. And he was interviewed, and some of the friends that were on the Natoma Bay were interviewed, and he met with his sister in the previous life as well, who also was convinced that he really was the reincarnation of her brother, who had been killed when he was only 20 or 22 years old.
I actually was thinking about this because I work with people on past lives a lot, and they're so detailed. And I was thinking if it isn't actually their soul that's been, in a past life and they've reincarnated this one, do you think that there's a way that maybe we're tapping into the collective consciousness and we're able to tap into lives that, just sort of just we grab hold of or something? Because it's very interesting how it works.
Well, there are some people who think that. I frankly, I don't know. I feel like we each have probably a higher self that has, the way one of the men that I interviewed about Edgar Cayce said it, it's like the higher self is the palm of your hand, and each life is like a finger. And of course, you have lots of fingers. But so that they are separate, but they're connected by the higher self, and which Christians would call the soul, I suppose. And that really only part of us incarnates at any one time. Whether we grab it from the collective unconsciousness, a life, or that's what we see, some people think that could be. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't know either, to be honest. Just, the more I'm researching about consciousness and, as we're talking about the one mind, everything is just one long energy wave, and we're just sort of part of that. Yes, we are frequencies that exist within that, but we're still part of it. It makes me think, well, if we are just a bundle of frequencies, then past lives are just frequencies as well. So, it
Yeah,
doesn't
I don't know.
necessarily.
Some people compare it to a wave on the ocean. A wave is a separate thing, but it's also part of the ocean, or a whirlpool that is in water, that could be you. It's part of the whole, but it's separate in a way. I don't know, but I do think I've had psychics. I spent some time out at the College of Metaphysics in Missouri, and they have psychics that do the same kind of work that Edgar Cayce. And I've had several past lives. I've been told about several past lives by these psychics, and they all make sense to me. That yeah, that was probably. I even have had flashes of memories from them. One, the last one being World War II. I think I was a pilot who was shot down, and previous ones to that. And one of the things that has came out in those series of lives that the psychic saw was my ability. I'm very intuitive, and if you know about Myers-Briggs, I'm an INTJ, which is someone who kind of sees big pictures of things and how everything fits together. And during those lives, there were certain things that occurred that I developed that ability over those lives. So that would make sense that it is a continuum, that our lives are just ours and not someone else's. But
Yeah, that reminds me of, because I know that a lot of people talk about how we choose our parents, and I've spent years pondering this because I really don't understand why people would choose their parents. But I now understand it from another angle. And I think what it is I think we're choosing the parents that have the skills that will allow us to learn certain things. So we're not choosing the parents per se, and the things that those parents then may do, to the child. That's not what we're choosing. We're choosing certain skills and attributes that, if you like, support us with these skills and attributes that we need to be learning about in that life. I think that's probably how it is. And I also think that our reality was definitely hijacked, but by, I think, much denser energies, and I think it changed things in a way that probably wasn't supposed to happen in that way.
If you want to trace materialism and how it got started, I have done some research on that. And I really found out about it because one of my ancestors, direct ancestor, seven times great grandmother, was one of the Salem witches. She was hanged in 1692. And I was, but to first address your question about or your thoughts about the parents, I definitely must have picked these parents that I had because my father was the son of a Methodist minister, but he didn't leave the church. He became a Unitarian, which is, that doesn't think that Christ was God. Well, thinks Christ was a great teacher, but he was, like all of us, part of God. And my mother was really jacked up about this ancestor of her husband who was hanged as a witch, and she just thought Christian fundamentalists were like, woo. So, but to answer your question about how did materialism come about, there was an Englishman who did it. His name was Thomas Hobbes, and he was a philosopher. He wrote the Leviathan, I think. But he was, in reference to the witch trials and that sort of thing, he said, if God made it, then that's all there is. And he's talking about physical reality. God made this, what we're living in. And so there's nothing else. In other words, there's no Satan, there's no demons, there's no heaven or hell. It's just this is it. And intellectuals, certainly in the United States, picked up on that. And I guess they probably did in England too. I don't know. But I know people like Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the founding fathers of our country, was what then was called a deist, the clockmaker theory. God made it, wound it up, and let it go, and is no longer involved in reality. And then, so a lot of intellectuals, this is what they thought, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, people like that. Then in Of course, along in the 19th century comes Charles Darwin, who in 1859 publishes The Origin of Species, which allowed them to get rid of God altogether. And so since then, in school, it's been taught that the only thing that exists is physical reality, and all that rest of that stuff is superstition, and it just doesn't exist, which we're now finding out is not true. But so for the last couple of hundred years, we've been in this materialistic framework, scientists trying to figure out how the brain creates consciousness can't do it because they're looking at it from the wrong direction. It's consciousness that creates matter, not matter that creates consciousness. So, yeah, for the last couple of hundred years, we've been taught in school that this is all there is. You're just a meat robot with a computer-like brain, and when you die, it's like pulling the plug on a vacuum cleaner. Kaput.
No, I hate that. I think why would you say that to a child? Why would you teach any of this stuff to a child? Like, just what demons, horrible people they are. I mean, when was Thomas Hobbes? When did he live?
This 17th century, I think, the date that sticks in my mind is 1688, maybe when he made that statement.
So, do you think that was to stamp out the Renaissance?
I think it was what he truly believed, and I don't think he had any ulterior motive, but who knows? Maybe he did.
The Renaissance, I think, was a period when we really started to become enlightened and people started to wake up. And then something happened and it just stamped it all out again. And then we went into the materialistic
Yeah, well, I think it
worldview.
was Hobbes that started it. I mean, that's from what I did a lot of study, and as I wrote a book about my ancestor, Susanna North Martin, who was hanged. I read all the trial transcripts of the witch trials are available, all the depositions that were taken, all that stuff. And there are a lot of contemporary accounts. And of course, Hobbes was living during that same time. And there were things like that going on in England as well. And he didn't believe that witches had any power. He believed that witches thought they were witches and that they had power, but he didn't believe that it was true. And that was basically what he was saying. I mean, he would probably been for hanging them just because they thought they were witches and were trying to put curses on people, but he didn't think the curses really could happen.
Yeah, so what did you find out about your, is it great grandmother?
Seven times great grandmother.
Seven times, okay.
Seven
So
greats.
what did you find out about her? Was she like putting curses on people, or was she just working with herbs and healing people?
She was a very feisty old lady who didn't suffer fools well. And she was 72 years old, which was very old in 1692. She was actually born in England, over in East Anglia, I think, and came over with John Winthrop in 1630, that flotilla that came to Massachusetts. And Massachusetts at that time was a theocracy. I think it was one of the Charleses granted Winthrop and others the ability to start a colony that was for Puritans who were kind of outcasts in England. So they went to Massachusetts, and so the Bible was the law book for them. And in, I believe it's Deuteronomy, there are a whole bunch of laws that go beyond the Ten Commandments that are little tiny laws. But one of them is, thou shalt not allow a sorceress or a sorcerer to live. So that's the basis of hanging witches. Susanna was a widow. She had eight children. Who were all grown at that time and had gone off on their own. And she ran the farm herself. She, plowed the fields, chopped the wood, did all the stuff you do in to live in the 17th century. And people didn't think that a woman could do that. And so that she must be a witch and using her powers to do all that kind of stuff. And there were people who testified. One of the testimony that kind of stands out that says it all, She actually did not live in Salem. She lived in Amesbury, which was about 20 miles away from Salem. And she went to see a friend in another town one spring when it had been raining. It was very muddy. And of course, they didn't have paved roads. And she walked the whole way, 10 or 15 miles. And when she got to the person's house and came in, her shoes were not muddy. And her long skirt was not muddy, so the person thought she must have flown there. What she probably did was stop, a little before the house and get herself cleaned up, and then come on in. But so that was the kind of testimony that proved that she must be a sorceress. And the accusers, when she was brought into the courtroom, would fall down in fits and things, like she was somehow tormenting them through her powers. So it was a really crazy thing. It's the name of the book, if anybody's, and I put my 21st century knowledge about what we've been talking about today to kind of analyze what's really going on there. Because of course, anybody who's written a book in the past has always thought there was no such thing as magic or witchcraft or any kind of supernatural abilities. And some people, they did find effigy dolls. She didn't. Susanna was not a witch. I don't think. There were a few of them who were practicing witchcraft. Probably one for sure, whose name was the last name was Bishop, Bridget Bishop or something like that. But they found effigy dolls hidden in her house. So she was, sticking pins in them and stuff like that. But yeah, there were something like 19 women and one man who were executed. One, and I would say probably only one of them was really a witch. There were over 150 who were accused, but they were eventually let out. They were in prison. They were in prison for about a year before the governor of Massachusetts called an end to all of that because his wife got accused and he decided that was going a little bit too far.
Just insane, isn't it? I think it's truly insane. I mean, the way that you're talking, it sounds exactly like how the Hollywood movies portray it. And I always think if it's in a Hollywood movie, then it's a pile of, BS. But it does sound like that's exactly what it is. But I have been researching magic for my second book, and it can be traced back to Babylonia. And it's these advanced people. It's who we call, well, the Babylonians, but a lot of people, say that these are the Anunnaki and all these sorts of things. And it all basically started from them. So these advanced people, they brought this knowledge, which I think is just advanced science that we just don't understand, but they brought this knowledge into this planet. And obviously, the other people on the planet, saw them as gods and things like this. But the interesting thing is that now there has been, I think it's in Germany, but they've now allocated 3.5 million euro to study the spread of magic and where it started. So it started from Babylonia, and then it moves through the Middle East, and then out into Asia, and then from Asia it comes back into Europe, and you can study it. So we can see that magic does exist. It has existed. It has come from somewhere. We don't quite know where, but I suspect it's either in a very advanced civilization that possibly evolved on a different landmass to us, which is what we call Atlantis or Lemuria, or they came from a different planet, but they had these advanced skills that we didn't have and didn't understand, but they brought them with us. So it's still being used today.
Yeah, when if you look at some of the architecture in well, not just Egypt and the pyramids, but also in the Americas, that is probably it's interesting because in the Americas at least, the most advanced structures in terms of huge stones that are fit together where you can't even get a razor in between the stones
Yeah.
are the oldest, and the ones that came after are less and less sophisticated as time goes by. So that says that there was an ancient civilization that somehow really knew how to do that. And some of the theories are that it has to do with sound. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I've studied magic a little bit. I think it can be, that it has to do with the mind and who is it that could bend spoons, Yuri or whatever his name is.
Yuri Geller, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd be fascinated to read your book on magic when you get it done. Let me know.
Well, it's not about magic, but it's trying to, again, it's trying to understand human origins, actually, because I really feel that once we understand who we are, where we've come from, then it's really going to help us to shift, to sort of take this consciousness shift and create a better world for ourselves. I just think that we're a lost species at the moment. We don't know who we are, and this is causing so many problems for so many people, I think. We need to start remembering who we really are.
Yeah, well, that's what the shift is all about, and it is coming. It's happening. I hope I live long enough to see it really come to fruition, totally. And I think it will be getting rid of all these wars and things when it finally has arrived, and we'll be treating each other much more graciously. So.
Yeah, because it's only a small minority, I think, who are even engineering all these things. I think they're engineering the wars, they're engineering everything for whatever reason it may be. But I do feel it's a small minority, and we are the majority. And I think, the faster we all start waking up to this, I think we can shift things very, very fast. So, and that's of course why we're talking today and doing this podcast, is to try and help that shift along a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think the motive is money. Wars make people rich. Somebody's got to make all that ammunition and all those tanks and airplanes and everything that they use. So, well, it's been fun talking to you today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate always your wisdom and all your research that you've obviously spent your entire life doing. You just
I
know
have
so
been.
much.
Yeah, I've been at it for 50 years.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's been lovely. So, how would you like to end? Like, how can people contact you? Is there anything you want to tell people about?
Yeah, I would like definitely come to my website, shmartin.com. Read about some of my books, about a project I've got where I'm working with a production studio to put together a TV show that will get this kind of information out, I hope. And take a look at my books. I've got one that really goes into what we're talking about today that's fairly new called Fast Track to Higher Consciousness, what they don't teach you in school about who and what you are and where you're headed. So that'll be on the home page. You can click on it, find out more about it, and even buy it if you want, both in paperback and hardcover, as well as an ebook, Kindle. So shmartin.com. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.
I'll put all the links and everything in the notes, don't worry, so people can have a look on there. But yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for joining me again for part two. And maybe in the future we'll have part three.
Okay, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Have a lovely weekend.